Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Epictetus was a Greek Stoic philosopher who was born into slavery and lived from 50 to 130 CE. Though Epictetus was just a teacher and wrote nothing of his own, his Stoic discourses were captured by his student Lucius Flavius Arrianus, known to scholars as Arrian. The guest on this episode is Robin Waterfield, an independent scholar and translator living in southern Greece. And the topic of our conversation is Epictetus, The Complete Works, Handbook, Discourses, and Fragments, out now from the University of Chicago Press. In this episode, we discuss the life of Epictetus, some characteristics of Stoicism, the life of Arrian, and more. You can visit Robin Waterfield online at robinwaterfield.com, and you can find me on Twitter at classical_ideas. It was a delight to meet with Robin again, 4 years after his first appearance on this show, and I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Robin Waterfield, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, Greg.
It's a delight to have you. I'm wondering if you can just spend a moment and introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners out there, however you see fit, so they know who you are and what you do.
Okay, well, I'm a British scholar. Oh, well, no, actually, I should say English now, since Britain seems to be falling apart. I'm a British independent scholar, which means I'm not attached to any university or college. I've lived for the past 15 years in the far south of Greece, and I also have Greek citizenship by now. I've had over 50 books published. In the early days, I wrote a variety of books, including children's fiction, but I've always specialized in the classical world, or more specifically in the ancient Greek world rather than the Roman world. And I even taught that at universities in the UK for a while. When I say I've had over 50 books published, I'm including translations, but not just because translating is pretty much as difficult in its way as writing a book, but also because I write the introductions and notes. I generally write the introductions and notes to my translations. And by the time I've done that, I've written original stuff at book length anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do, really. I live in the south of Greece. I also have a small olive farm producing beautiful olive oil, and I write books, and that's it.
I love that. I remember you talking about your olive farm last time you were here. One of the other books that you wrote, How Socrates Died, was something that you and I talked about on this exact show for the June 25th, 2018 episode. And I actually had to go back and find the exact date that I put that out, because I was like, we have to talk about this.
I was a podcast virgin. That was my first podcast.
Amazing. And have you done a lot since then?
I've done a lot since then, particularly during COVID, when, you know, people were getting used to using Zoom and things like that. And so, yes, I've done a lot since then, but you were my first, Greg.
That is so amazing. I absolutely love that. And so we actually get to talk face to face now. We didn't get to do that the first time around. So this is like such a delight. And, you know, so it's great to have you back, Robin. And, you know, I'm wondering how your life and work has been since you were last here over 4 years ago. Because, I mean, so much has changed. We're talking about like a different world then. How has your time been since then?
Well, I mean, in a sense, of course, much of it has been pretty much the same as everybody else's. In other words, you know, I was in COVID lockdowns and restrictions and things like that. I mean, there's a sense in which COVID didn't really change my life that much, because pretty much all I do, as I've already said, is sit at my desk and write books.
Yeah.
I had to find a way around the fact that libraries were closed, because I need access to good academic libraries, but the worldwide community of classical scholars was fantastically helpful when it came to supplying material that was unavailable to me. I subscribed to a classics listserv, and I just put up requests on that, and I had the papers and even the books within a few days. So since we spoke in, we actually spoke in May 2018, but it was published in June. Since then, I've had 4 translations published, including this recent one, Epictetus, and 2 original books, one on the ancient Olympic Games and one on the obscure, very obscure, 3rd century BCE and the Macedonian king Antigonus Gonatas.
Wonderful. What are the titles of those other two that we don't have a chance to discuss today?
The Olympic Games one is called Olympia, the story of the Olympic Games, I think.
Okay.
And the Antigonus Gonatas book is called The Making of a King, Antigonus Gonatas of Macedon and the Greeks.
Wonderful. I just wanted to make sure we get those out there. So we are going to dive into your new book out now through the University of Chicago Press called Epictetus, The Complete Works, Handbook, Discourses, and Fragments. Tell me about the origin of this project and kind of how this like took shape for you over the last couple of years.
Well, it came about in a very mundane fashion, really. I mean, that book I've just mentioned, The Making of a King, Antigonus Gonatas of Macedon and the Greeks, was published by the University of Chicago Press. I think as an act of generosity, they wanted me on their list because it's an obscure topic, and that book was never going to be a bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my contact with Chicago, who've also published the Epictetus. And then secondly, I had already translated for Basic Books an annotated edition of another Stoic thinker, Marcus Aurelius's famous Meditations. And since I really enjoyed doing that, I offered Epictetus to Chicago, who had already published the complete works of Epictetus's most important Stoic predecessor, Seneca the Younger. And they said yes. And so I got down and did it.
Amazing. I love it. You know, something that is, this has been a topic that's been long requested on this show. I've never done an episode on Stoic studies at all. This is my very first one. I've never mentioned Epictetus on the show that I can remember. And so this is brand new. So I love being able to recognize and make a note for the listeners when I'm talking about something for the first time, because it's like I get to learn in real time about these topics that are still brand new to me years after doing this show. So I'm wondering if we can tease out a couple of terms here. You know, maybe defining Stoicism, like kind of giving like a little potted introduction to that topic in general might be a good place to start. What do you think?
Okay, I'll try. I mean, it's a huge topic, of course. There are whole books written about Stoicism, but I'll see what I can do in a nutshell. Nowadays, of course, Stoicism means, what should we say, the ability to endure hardship without complaining and without displaying emotion. And that is a true reflection of ancient Stoicism, but there's a lot more to it than that. Stoicism was not a matter of faith. Every one of their tenets was argued for, but I don't have time to explain the arguments. That
sure.
Really would take a long time. So here's a kind of a bullet list of the main characteristics, or at least the main characteristics in one of 3 fields. The Stoics divided philosophy into 3 fields: physics, logic, and ethics. And I'll focus on ethics because that's Epictetus's focus in the discourses.
Mm-hmm.
So the starting point for the Stoics is that the only good thing there is virtue, and the only thing that is bad is vice or imperfection. Only a fully virtuous person is truly happy or fulfilled. Everything else, everything other than virtue or vice, is what the Stoics called an indifferent. It's neither good nor bad, and it has nothing to contribute to our happiness or misery. That means, 99.9% of what we encounter in the world is, for the Stoics, an indifferent.
Mm.
But we, people, treat indifference, such as pleasure, wealth, health, and so on, as if they were important. And that is what attaches us to the material world and its values. This is the fundamental error. In Stoic terms, we assent to mistaken propositions, such as that pleasure is good, and so we drag ourselves down to the level of beasts or infants. But you can see, I think, straight away how extremely difficult it is to be an enlightened Stoic sage. Only a fully virtuous person is truly happy or fulfilled. But since 99% of our lives is dealing with indifference, and generally getting caught up in them, even the Stoics admitted that a fully enlightened sage was a rara avis, as rare as, I can't remember what they said, as rare as the phoenix or something like that anyway, but extremely rare.
Mm.
But this stark position was slightly diluted. The good life, one of the most common ways the Stoics describe the good life, the life we should all be leaving, is that it is lived in accordance with nature. But human nature, as granted us by the benevolent God, involves, let's say, good health rather than ill health. That is our natural state. So from that point of view, living in accord with nature means having good health rather than ill health. So among the infinite class of indifference, although none of them are either good or bad, some were allowed to be what they call preferred indifference. So good health is a preferred indifferent. A moderate amount of wealth is a preferred indifferent. Anything which allows us or helps us to live in accord with nature is a preferred indifferent. We don't want it, but we can choose it. We can select it, I said. Next, I should say that virtue is knowledge. The virtue of courage, for instance, is knowing what is truly fearful and what isn't. Now, if virtue is knowledge, then behaving non-virtuously is a product of ignorance. Everyone thinks that everything they do is good for them, but we're simply often objectively mistaken in this. We have to cultivate knowledge and rationality, which is to say we cultivate the divine in us, since God is perfected reason. We will act well and appropriately when all our actions are rationally justifiable. Hence, self-regarding behavior is appropriate because it's rationally justifiable. It preserves us. I look after myself, I look after my body, it preserves me. That is appropriate behavior because it's in accord with nature. But other regarding behavior, justice, kindness to others, thinking about others and their concerns, is also appropriate because in order to be good to yourself, you have to be good to others. As I say, that was one of the points that was argued for, but I can't go into the arguments. Now, that's a kind of a bare bullet list, and I appreciate that it's going to beg dozens of questions, but those are the most important Stoic teachings that underlie and inform Epictetus's work.
Well, where I kind of am curious now is like some of the, going through school and growing up and going to university and things like that throughout my own life, like you come across these names of these like ancient figures who are, well known within certain fields, and then they come up, but then they get like listed like quickly in college courses and they get kind of just blasted through. And I'm wondering if you can like, tease out a couple of the major figures within Stoic studies that, are important to you as somebody who studies these things, professionally. What are some folks, some other stuff that we should read and look at as well, too?
Well, Stoicism was founded in around the turn of the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. So it had a long history. The work of the earliest Stoics, in fact, the work of all the Stoics up until Seneca, Epictetus's predecessor in Roman imperial times, the work of all the Stoics exists only in fragments. But nevertheless, it's clear from later references that the first three heads of the school were placed on a very high pedestal. They were Zeno. This is not the Zeno of Zeno's Paradoxes. Lots of people have heard of Zeno's Paradoxes, but that was a different Zeno. This is Zeno, originally of Kitium in Cyprus. He was the first head of the school. And then Cleanthes, and then Chrysippus. They were the first three heads of the school in the early 3rd century BCE. And of these, Chrysippus was the most important theoretician of Stoicism. And ever since his work, he wrote dozens and dozens of books. Ever since his work, the Stoics looked back to him. So, for instance, when I say that Epictetus was a Stoic teacher, that means, above all, that he based his teaching on the work of Chrysippus. So these three, Zeno, Cleanthes, and especially Chrysippus, established Stoic orthodoxy. In the centuries between them and Epictetus's time, in the second century, the end of the first and the beginning of the second century AD or CE, there were plenty of other eminent and important Stoics, such as Aristo, Diogenes of Babylon, Panaetius, Posidonius, but they weren't always fully orthodox. So I skip over to the Stoics of the Roman imperial period, where, as I've just said, for the first time, we have complete texts. And there, the most important Roman Stoics were Seneca the Younger, Musonius Rufus, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius.
Excellent. So I want to know a little bit about the life of Epictetus. What can reasonably be known about him with any degree of certainty?
Well, very little. Most of what we know is based on what we can glean from reading between the lines of the discourses themselves. But nevertheless, we can know enough to give at least a sort of an outline of his life. He lived, let's say, from maybe 50, maybe 60 CE to 130-ish. Interestingly, he was born a slave. And he was born in what is now southwestern Turkey, a city called Hierapolis. At some point in his childhood or youth, he was taken to Rome, and he worked there in the household of an important man who was close to the Emperor Nero. He was given his freedom at around the age of 30, and before long, he set himself up as a teacher of Stoic philosophy. Along with a bunch of other philosophers, he was expelled from Rome by the Emperor Domitian in around 93. Philosophers were often suspected of having republican sympathies, and so emperors didn't approve of them. Epictetus moved to the west coast of Greece and set up his school there. He lived in the city of Nicopolis, which was the capital of the Roman province of Epirus, and was not a difficult sea journey away from Italy, where many of his students came from. So that was where he taught. He just lived in Nicopolis and taught in Nicopolis for 30 years or so before retiring. And then he died, as I say, around 130.
You know, as I was reading through the book the other day, I noticed that there is a figure who seems completely essential to the story of Epictetus, and that's Lucius Flavius Arianus. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that person's role and importance in the works of what we know about Epictetus in general.
Well, he was let's start from a slightly different angle. He became a very important writer in his own right.
Oh, cool.
For instance, he wrote about Alexander the Great's Eastern expedition. And even though he was writing in the second century AD, 500 years after Alexander, his account of Alexander's Eastern expedition is still considered to be the best, or at least one of the very best. But before he became a famous writer like that, he studied with Epictetus in Nicopolis. And his great bequest to us, to future generations, was that he somehow managed to transcribe Epictetus's discourses. What we have four books of discourses. There were probably more. Well, there were certainly more, but we don't know how many more books there were originally. But they were all transcribed by Arian. as we call him, Flavius Lucius Arrian. Lucius Flavius Arrianus is known to us as Arrian. How he did this is, I mean, slightly miraculous. He must have known stenography, or perhaps he had an educated slave who knew stenography. That was not an impossible task for an enslaved person in those days. Because it still seems miraculous, because as you read the discourses, you can see that they were delivered live, they were delivered extempore, they were delivered off the cuff, and the delivery was often very rapid. But somehow Arrian managed to get these down. There may have been already a stock of at least some of the discourses, but it's really due to Arrian that we owe the discourses. And in addition to writing the discourses, or in addition to transcribing the discourses, he also wrote a book which is simply known as the Handbook or the Manual, which is Arrian's own words, but based very heavily on the discourses. Arrian's way of introducing Epictetus's thought, perhaps for students who'd heard of Epictetus's fame and might be interested in following it up and going and studying at his school.
Excellent.
So without Arrian, we wouldn't have Epictetus.
I love that. I love those really important turning points and stories like that, because it's like this one person makes all of these things possible centuries later. And it's really kind of beautiful and romantic if you think about it.
Yeah, that very often happens. It just so happens that in this case, we actually know the name of the person who did it.
So cool. You know, something that stands out to me about the biography of Epictetus is his past as a slave. And I'm curious about how something like that influences his teachings in a way that makes him stand out from other ancient teachers who may have had like a different station in life or started from a different place. What really stands out to you within his teaching that is kind of unique among his contemporaries due to his periods of enslavement in his life?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. And I think there's no doubt that Epictetus's time as a slave did leave its mark on his teaching. There are resemblances between, all the way from Plato, even his predecessors, all the way through to the Stoics and the Epicureans. There are certain kind of family resemblances among the schools of ancient philosophy. They all insisted that it was a way to be enlightened, in our terms, to make the best of yourself. But more than any other philosopher that I know of, Epictetus insisted that however else one described the goal of life, it must be a state of freedom. And this is where I think his background as a slave left its mark. A state of freedom where, as he puts it at one point in the discourses, everything that happens to a person is in accord with his will, and no one is able to impede him. The starting point of his teaching, and we'll come back to this perhaps in a moment, is that some things are up to us and some things aren't. The events of our lives, our parents, the people we meet, everything that happens to us, these things are not up to us. It's not in our power to change them. We are not free in relation to these things. I wasn't free to choose my parents. You weren't free to choose your parents, etc., etc. In Epictetus's terms, they were given to us by God. And since God is only ever good and takes care of his children, we should just accept them and make use of them as the materials on which to get good at the art of living. Just as leather is the material for a cobbler, these events in our lives are our materials for practicing virtue. One important consequence of this is that to pray for our lives to be different is a kind of blasphemy for Epictetus, because it's an implicit denial that God is doing what is best for us. But what's up to us, what's within our power, is how we react to all these God-given or predestined events, the Stoics were determinists. We can control our internal states, our desires and inclinations, our choices, our judgments, our hopes and fears, and so on and so forth. In short, all the things that make up our characters. And the way we control them is by paying attention to our use of impressions, as Epictetus puts it, which is to say, what propositions we are sent to. This is how we get to be free. So his point is that no one that can stop you having the inclinations you have or making the choices that you make. In the sphere of our inner lives, we are totally and utterly free. And just as a footnote to that, I'll say that that, to me, is why the scene in George Orwell's 1984 is so terrifying, the one where Winston Smith is being tortured until he admits that 2 + 2 = 5.
Right.
Because 2 + 2 = 4 is one of Epictetus' standard examples of a proposition that you can only assent to because it is true. And so, but Winston Smith was being forced to assent to something that was false.
Is there any documentation that George Orwell was an appreciator of Stoic studies?
Not that I know of, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
True. I love it. You know, in the introduction to the book, you say something that really caught my eye as I was going through the different teachings. You say that the point of reading texts is to learn how to judge things correctly and then apply those judgments in real life situations. And I was thinking about how ordinary, mundane things that happen to us on any given day, like, you know, getting caught behind somebody at a red signal in your car for too long, or, you know, the weather being terrible, and how these things have such a determining factor over our everyday lives for so many people, and how such mundane things can like ruin our day-to-day existence. It got me really thinking about this quote of like applying judgments in our real life. And so I definitely wanted to ask you about, you know, some of your favorite Epictetus teachings. Like, do you have like a top three to connect to examples of like the way you see your own day-to-day life? Do you like have some favorite lessons from throughout the book that you would like to, you know, reflect upon?
I wouldn't really say that they're anything is my personal favorite. This is one of the odd things about working as a translator, is that the way you approach the text isn't really in a personal fashion. You're simply trying to reproduce as faithfully as possible what you read there, rather than kind of necessarily applying it to yourself. So I wouldn't say that I had favorite teachings in that particular sense, but what I would say is that one of the great things, I mean, you asked, do I have a top three favorite teachings? But what the great thing about Epictetus is that there isn't really a top three in his discourses, at any rate, which is all that survives. What he's doing there is he reduces the complexity of Stoic practical ethics to its simplest foundations. So rather than there being a top three, there's really only one axiom. And I certainly appreciate this axiom.
Sure.
And everything else he says follows from and is an elaboration of the single axiom. And the axiom is the one with which Arrian started the handbook. Some things are up to us and some things aren't. And what he means by this is roughly as follows. I've covered some of this already, but it's worth repeating because, as I say, it is actually the core of Epictetus' teaching. So some things are up to us. Some things are not up to us, I should say first. They are external to us and just happen to us, as I've said before, the events of our lives and so on and so forth. But our minds are our own, and we can control our internal states and our responses to events. These things are up to us and can't be thwarted by anyone or anything else. If you know that it's daylight today, no one can make you say that it's night. That's one of Epictetus's examples. So we need to learn to accept experiences and events over which we have no control, to recognize them as indifferent, to bring up that term again, and to use them as the materials on which to practice virtue. We need to see them as the gifts of a providential God who steers and arranges everything in the universe, great and small, for the best, especially for his favorite creatures, humankind. And in this way, fated events become opportunities, not constraints. So if we understand that our happiness doesn't depend on our bodies and possessions and careers, but on the mental faculties that are up to us, on the use of our will, then we'll free ourselves of negative emotions, those that are not supportive of our natural potential for goodness. And our rational faculty, the distinctive part of the human being, will begin to work better now that it's uncluttered by unnecessary reactions. It will begin to judge things correctly. And since everything bad that happens to us is a result of our own wrong judgments, will start to live well. In other words, what Epictetus is saying is that it's a fact of our human nature that we have all the resources we need to achieve happiness in a smoothly flowing life. No one empowers or disempowers us except ourselves. Moment by moment, we need to assess our mental condition to make sure that we're focusing only on things that are up to us and not letting externals worry us. And that way we can take control of our lives. So you see, from that single axiom,
yeah,
some things are up to us and some aren't, you get this increasing density of thought. And I don't mean dense in the sense of incomprehensible at all, because Epictetus is wonderfully clear.
Yeah.
But just from that single axiom, everything else follows. And so that's his, you see, he was a teacher. He was obviously a practicing Stoic as well. But what we mainly see of him is as a teacher. And so it was important for him as a teacher to simplify things, to take things back to their rock bottom basics. And that's why he came up with this single axiom.
Yeah, the book is wonderfully clear as well. Like, it's really accessible, because I'm not a specialist in this field. You know what I mean? I'm just a high school teacher who likes talking to people about their scholarship. So for someone like me, who very much has not studied these topics, to, you know, be able to dive into something like this and comprehend what's happening, I mean, it says a lot to me, because I'm just that kind of reader. You know what I mean?
I'm glad.
Yeah. So it works. It's wonderful. You know, living where you live in the world too, you've been on this show twice now. We talked about Socrates. We talked about Epictetus. I'm wondering if you have any, if you do any travels around your work, if you go to places around the region that you've relocated to, and if you have any just like adventure stories that you'd like to share from like living in this part of the world that you study as a scholar.
When I write my history books, yes, my wife and I, take a couple of weeks away from home and we drive around. Like, for instance, when I wrote a book on the Roman conquest of Greece, the Romans came into what is now Albania and Croatia. And so we traveled all the way through Albania and Croatia and places like that. But when I do my translations, not so much. So I've never done, as it were, a dedicated Epictetus tour. He was born, as I mentioned before, in Hierapolis, in what is now southwest Turkey. And I've Googled that, and it looks wonderful. There are quite a lot of ancient remains left, and it looks well worth a visit. And I'd like to get there sometime. I don't know the ancient remains of Turkey half as well as I'd like to. I've seen a number of them, but not by far from all. And I've been to... Okay, so I mean, the three chief places associated with Epictetus would be that place, Hierapolis, in southwestern Turkey, Rome, where he then lived for maybe as much as 20 years. But when you visit Rome, it would be very hard to get a sense of his presence because everything's so crowded.
Sure.
You know, you've got the modern city and so on and so forth. But Nicopolis, where he lived on the, as I say, for the 30 years or so of his life on the west coast of Greece, the ruins there are on their own. And I have visited Nicopolis, well, years before that, before I even dreamt of translating Epictetus. And that's really the first place I would suggest that people might go if they wanted to get a sense of his presence, because he lived there so long. There are various remains in Nicopolis, but two stand out. First of all, the city walls are magnificent. Actually, I should have thought in advance, and then I could do a screen share and I could have put up a picture of the city walls, but it's too late now.
Yeah.
Anyway, the city walls are magnificent. A very long stretch of them survives, to a height and to a length more than anywhere I've seen elsewhere. So you really get a sense of the importance and the grandeur of the city. And second, there's the Actium Memorial. Now, Nicopolis was founded by Octavian, soon to be Augustus, the first emperor of Rome. Its name means victory city. Its name and its location commemorate the final victory of Augustus over his rivals, who in this case were Antony and Cleopatra, in the Roman civil wars. The main memorial of his victory is what is still surviving to a certain extent, and it would have been originally a vast edifice of stone inscribed with details of his naval victory, and sporting almost 40 of the bronze rams of his enemies' captured ships. It's still stands alone on a hill, and it's well worth a visit. It's easy to imagine its original splendor.
That is so cool. I love stuff like that. Because I'm hoping to get back to that part of the world now that things are, you know, moving into the next phase of human society and civilization. What is next for you? Because you were here 4 years ago to chat about one of your books, and you know, then you've got this several new books since you and I have last chatted. Mm-hmm. What's coming up next for you?
I've got a biography of Plato. Curiously, can you imagine this? I mean, given how famous Plato is, this will be the first ever book-length biography of Plato.
Amazing.
So I've got, that is at the moment just starting its process through production at Oxford University Press, and that'll be out perhaps next May. I hope next May. So that's an original book I wrote, not a translation. But I'm 70 now, Greg, and I think I'm going to de-stress my life a bit. So unless a really juicy project occurs to me or falls into my lap, I think I'll focus more on translating than on writing original books. So I've done the Epictetus. At the moment, I'm translating Thucydides, the historian, his History of the Peloponnesian War. I'm translating that for Basic Books, who published by Marcus Aurelius. And hopefully further translations will follow. As I say, I'll keep an open mind. If a really juicy project falls into my lap, I'll take it up. But otherwise, I've got a lot of translating to do.
Well, Robin Waterfield, it is a delight to have you back on the show. You are invited anytime to come back and chat about those future books. So anytime you want to come back, you're very welcome here. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much, as I said, for having me.